Our next speaker is Leonie Burdack. She has broad experience working in a range of different portfolios and settings at the international, national, and jurisdictional levels, and also in the community sector. This includes whole of government and organizational policy development, legislation development and compliance, change and project management. Leonie has more than 30 years nursing experience working in both public and private sectors in Australia and also the United Kingdom. Currently, she works as an emergency nurse practitioner. Leonie is a founding member of the current, and she's also the current vice president of the Australian College of Nurse Practitioners. Let's welcome Leonie.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank the first two speakers this morning for setting the scene really nicely for what I'm going to say. I guess it was really reassuring also yesterday to hear the comments that were made by the various speakers. We often talk as an executive about whether we're a bit too close to our own issue and whether we're really reflecting what's happening. But I guess after hearing the speakers so far, I think we're probably on the right track. What I'd like to do is spend the first couple of minutes just providing very quick context. I'll just do two slides doing that. And then I'll go on to present what we've been working on, or one of the issues that we've been working on over the last 12 to 18 months. For those of you that might not be as familiar as others, although I expect I'm probably speaking to the converted, nurse practitioners are highly trained and experienced registered nurses. They go on to do additional tertiary education at the university level. They've got extensive clinical training. Their extended skills and experiences qualifies them to work beyond the traditional role of the registered nurse, and it includes advanced assessment, management, requesting and referring, and interpreting tests, and also referring on to other health professionals. They also do prescribing. The title of the nurse practitioner is protected under legislation, so you just can't wake up and call yourself a nurse practitioner. And I think that's probably one thing that we've done very well in Australia. There's other countries where the title is not protected. There's lots of hoops you need to jump through to get your registration through APRA. We have in April we reached a milestone where we had over 1,000 nurse practitioners registered in Australia. 84% of nurse practitioners have a minimum of 12 years experience as a registered nurse, often with postgraduate qualifications and specialty experience. 64% or more of nurse practitioners that are working in Australia at the moment have more than 18 years experience working as a registered nurse before they become a nurse practitioner. Okay, just to give you a bit of a snapshot of the progress and the history of nurse practitioners in Australia, we're relatively new comparatively to overseas. Nurse practitioners have been around since the 1960s. They're really just a couple of the major milestones. We first grew legs, I guess, and operated under the auspices of the Australian Nurse Practitioners Association. Some academics who are still very proactive in presenting research and evidence for nurse practitioner models of care were fortunate to get a fairly coveted ARC grant in 2007, which really provided a lot of demographics and a lot of information about how nurse practitioner models were being utilised throughout the health service. 2008 was quite significant. We were invited for the first time to participate in the primary healthcare roundtable, so we actually started to have a voice for nursing and for our patients in the model of the care that we provided. We registered as a company in 2009, and I guess the momentum milestone for nurse practitioners was in 2010 when we got access to MBS and PBS. Our colleagues overseas often say, wow, you've progressed that really quickly. I don't think, I guess there's been a lot of blood, sweat and tears behind it, but we were very fortunate. We had Minister Roxon, and picking up on the our introduction speaker, she was determined to implement policy and not politic. She was prepared to stick a neck on the line and confront some of our adversaries. and look at patient outcomes and what was best for the health sector. We were also very fortunate at that time, and I think it's probably becoming more and more unusual, but we had two senior bureaucrats in the Department of Health who were constant for 2 years. They were willing to listen, they were willing to... No, that's really quite unusual because they change every 6 months, as most of you know. So I guess they were willing to listen. They looked at all the different options and the evidence available for supporting those practitioners. And I guess all the planets lined up, and that's where we are at the moment. That said, it's been a rocky road, and there's still lots of remnants in the system. I suspect it'll be another 10 years before we make a lot of inroads, so we're going to keep trying. It's not, I guess, unsurprising when you superimpose new models of care in an existing system that you develop anomalies. And when we went into, once we got the legislation through, there was another 12 months of sitting around the table over at DOA with all the stakeholders and trying to nut out the details of what actually sat behind that legislation. Even at that point in time, we couldn't really anticipate how the nurse practitioner model would really develop. And particularly at that time, there were very few nurse practitioners that were working in primary healthcare. So there was a whole lot of unknowns at that point in time. We work in collaboration with a range of other healthcare professionals, and that leads us to work across the boundaries between the acute hospital care setting and also in the community. I guess unless the barriers that we've identified are addressed, we're concerned that the patients and the taxpayers are not getting their best value for money. And so we've looked at what the key issues are and tried to address those over the last 12 months, or 12 to 18 months. Some of the barriers that have started to emerge, particularly as we get nurse practitioners working in the primary healthcare, is the MBS claim system. And although we very much support the MBS system, I think I'm certainly on record of saying it's a perverse system. It's very much a funding system, and it's not necessarily about what's best for health outcomes. One of the issues that we have as nurse practitioners is that we have time-based item numbers, which does not fit the model of care. If a nurse practitioner was to go and see an elderly patient in their home and try and work them up for a health assessment, once you get family involved and provide a comprehensive total health assessment, it can take up to 4 hours by the time you look at care, assess all the things that need to bring into that house to help that patient. The maximum item number for consultation time for nurse practitioners is 40 minutes. Conversely, if you're going into a medical centre, there's the time for seeing that patient, and then there's a claim against that item number. So it makes the nurse practitioner role has never been really grown up to be a get-rich-quick scheme. However, it needs to be viable, and we're finding that more and more within the primary healthcare sector, as nurse practitioners start to grow in numbers, we very much rely on medical colleagues to make the role viable. And, you know, surprisingly, in the early days it was really difficult, but there's some fantastic models developing where GPs, specialty doctors are really embracing the role, but the only reason that the nurse practitioner role is surviving is because they're actually propping it up in terms of economic viability. One of the things that has presented in the public sector is a transboundary model of care. It's emerged because nurse practitioners actually go out to the patient rather than have the patient come to them. And what we've found happening is that patients that are discharged from the acute care system into the care of their GP will often contact the nurse practitioner after that episode of care. So it's a kind of a grey zone that used to be, for some of you that have been in healthcare for a long time, was the old community setting for healthcare, which I would suggest is in many ways, depending on what the issue is, it's an unfunded area. It's a grey zone, and the patient keeps jumping between the acute care system and the private practice system. but there's a grey zone that's not really being serviced properly. The patients, one example that I can give you is we have a nurse practitioner working in New South Wales. She's public sector. She's a women's health nurse practitioner, and she actually goes out to the women who need different medical assessment, just even health promotion. She's actually sourced a shearing shed. She had to find a shed that had electricity and lighting. And the women come in around from, it's up near Newcastle, they come in from around the rural areas. Not a long way away, but a lot of them don't drive, so they don't go into Newcastle. And she actually does women's health screens and a whole lot of assessments and things in a shearing shed setting. As these women started to build a rapport with this nurse practitioner, they were also saying, oh, by the way, I've got blood pressure medication, or this is wrong, or that's wrong. She's now developed a really good relationship with the general practitioner, who realises that if these women don't actually access this service, they're not accessing proper healthcare at all. And so she's now extended her scope and actually does some of the additional primary care with these women. One of the issues that she does find is that because she's a public sector nurse, however, she doesn't have a provider number, and that's a really big issue in terms of providing services ensuring that the patient can actually get the rebate, that they don't have to pay maximum dollar. And that's not an atypical example. So if we look at this grey zone, there's lots of examples, particularly in chronic care. I'll give you an example of a nurse practitioner that works in Queensland who is an expert. Her expertise is in cardiac failure. Often a patient will be admitted to the acute care system. They will go home, discharged from the acute care system into the care of their general practitioner. The general practitioner will then continue to manage as would anybody that goes back into the community. Every so often she'll get a phone call from the patient's family to say, could you please come and see my mum or my dad or whoever it might be. I'm a little bit concerned they're starting to deteriorate, their chest sounds wet. Or occasionally she'll get a call from the GP to say, I've had a call from Mrs. So-and-so. I think she's starting to sort of go over the edge. I think she probably needs her medications adjusted. I don't have time. Or on some occasions the GP will say, well, this is a fairly complex case. You have the expertise. I'm not really across all the cardiac medications. Would you mind going and seeing her? So the nurse practitioner will go out and see the patient and say, yep, okay, well, you need a chest x-ray, you need X, you need Y. Because she hasn't got a provider number, she then has to either send the patient in to the hospital or ring the GP, some GPs will very kindly say, yep, I'll write you out the form, come and pick it up. Or, not prepared to do it unless you send the patient into my surgery. The patient will sometimes have to wait for 2 days to get into the surgery. By that time, they've developed florid cardiac failure, need to call an ambulance and go into the hospital. So it's a bit of a dilemma. There's been one situation where she was so desperate to get the patient appropriate care that she did a one-hour round trip to go back to the hospital to get one of the consultants to write a pathology form to get the appropriate management for this patient. Other examples would include nurse practitioners that are called to go out and see patients, elderly patients in their home that had an episode of care in the acute care system. There's lots of evidence out there to show that early intervention for a mild chest infection or urinary tract infection prevents sepsis, and particularly for old people or older people, sepsis is a huge insult on the body. If they're admitted to the acute care system, on the first to admit, we don't do very well. We take them out of their routine, they get confused, and that's before we even start treating the medical problem. So I guess one of the things we identified was, this was before the election, so the fiscal environment was pretty tight anyway. We looked at all the list of things that were creating barriers for the model of care, and we identified that probably this was the best bang for buck, both in terms of what we could provide for savings for the government and also best value for money in terms of patient outcomes. We commissioned a report to try... we know that from talking to our senior bureaucrats and policymakers, their eyes just gloss over when we say that we made the patient feel good and they lived happily ever after. They want dollars and cents. That's the only language they speak. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of quantitative data around, but the report did show the things that you see up there on the board in front of you. Particularly, we were able to show that potentially there was we weren't able to do any economic modelling. The quote that we got to do that was just out of our league, way out of our league to do anything substantial. But we were able to pull together the data that we had to show that we could decrease budget burden through early intervention and management, so preventing hospital admissions. And we could also reduce the number of episodes of care billed to MBS. If a nurse practitioner could complete the full episode of care when she saw these patients, he or she saw the patient in the community, they wouldn't have to go on to the GP to then just get their pathology form. And quite often what would happen is the nurse practitioner would write a referral, say, Mrs. So-and-so needs such and such. The GP would say, yep, that's great. Charge Medicare for the service. Write the form and the patient will go away. In cases where the nurse practitioner saw the patient in the community, there was always that collaborative arrangement where they were talking with the GP for ongoing management or, if needed, the specialist in the hospital system. We believe that the model that we're proposing creates a win-win for the Commonwealth. It decreases the bills, the number of services that go to MBS, as I've already said. It improves the patient's journey through the system. Prevents or reduces the incidence of deterioration requiring transfer to hospital. And I've given you the heart failure as an example, renal failure is another example. And it's also, certainly at the stage that we were lobbying this with government, it also provided an advantage to the states. And the states were actually tolerating this, mainly because of the four-hour rule and the funding that was attached to that. So they were actually tolerating what we said to politicians, they could quite rightly say, I'm sorry, but this is a Commonwealth government-funded service that we're providing. So there was lots of evidence around to show that what we were doing was efficacious. We didn't, as I said, there wasn't a lot of quantitative research, but there was enough stuff that we could pull out from the literature. In addition to that, there was a case study that was costed by an area health service in northern New South Wales, which showed that an aged care nurse practitioner that was actually going out and seeing people in their homes in the scenario that I've just described saved the hospital over $280,000 in just 1 month by early intervention, prevention, and preventing the patients from being transferred into the hospital system. And that was at a time when the government statistics were showing admission rates of 52% for patients over 70 years of age. We also found that there was precedent set. In the Commonwealth, there was refer provider number, which allowed nurse practitioners to do the very thing that we wanted them to be able to do. So the government wasn't being charged for a consultation process through the MBS item numbers. The state were picking that up. All we were asking the Commonwealth to do was to pick up the cost to rebate the patient for the x-ray or the pathology. We lobbied, went to our allies first, consumer and some of the industry people who gave us a few pointers. They said you're going to come up against cost shifting. We spoke to politicians, we spoke to Treasury, who thought it was a fantastic model, and they thought it would probably be picked up by the new funding arrangements that came out on 1st of July this year, but we all know the funding model has changed. Jurisdictions thought it was a good idea, but again, once we started getting down to the government level, there was talk about cost shifting, and I can honestly say after working in government positions. I was working in the Commonwealth during the Howard era in the lead up to the Olympic Games, and there was lots of argy-bargy then between the states and the Commonwealth, but I have never ever seen in all my life the amount of argy-bargy and cost-shifting argument that goes on at the moment. Once we started talking to the politicians, we got bipartisan support. We talked to both major parties, the miners, we talked to everybody. They thought it was a fantastic model. But at the end of the day, it came back to who's going to pay. The bottom line didn't make any difference. The fact that there were cost savings, it always came back to who was going to pay. So next steps, that's where we're at the moment. The next steps are we will continue to lobby. I think it's been reassuring to hear from others today that today and yesterday that we are on the right track. There is a cost saving there. There is some waste in the system, albeit that it's minor. But most importantly, it's about the patient focus. And I think as a patient, as the speaker said yesterday, maybe what we need to go back, instead of finding solutions and twigging with the dollars and the cents, go back and see what the issues are, get a model that works and actually progress that, and then work out who's going to pay. We will continue to advocate for patient-centred models of care. We're using some of the North American models, and Julie, the model that you provided is fantastic. Team-based, the right person for the right problem, and we will continue to also advocate for quality measures. A lot of the stuff that's out there at the moment, as you know, is all about quantitative. I'll just finish off with a really quick, an extract, just to give you the tone. And I guess it shows that maybe quantitative measures is not all that's about healthcare. This was from a short extract from an interview that was done by a nurse practitioner that works in rural and remote, and the family has given permission for us to use this example. She talks about working in rural and remote and how the norm of good health is much lower than what you would expect and is accepted in remote because it is remote. She talks about her experiences involving providing palliative care to a 54-year-old Aboriginal woman who refused dialysis. She'd been looking after this lady for quite some time, monitoring her blood levels, keeping her as well as she possibly could, monitoring medications, etc. She was a strong senior, she says here, she was a strong senior, very traditional woman for the community, and she had seen her sister die in Alice Springs on dialysis. And something that she'd always said was that she didn't want to be the same. As her health deteriorated, she continued hunting, engaging in traditional ceremonies, involved in community activities, playing cards and caring for the grandchildren. The woman respectfully talked about how she didn't want dialysis, but well-meaning health service providers wanted the woman to receive treatment. She talks about a phone call that she got one day. This lady deteriorated, and the carers in Alice Springs admitted this lady to the hospital. And she said, I received a call from the patient who was quite distressed. She didn't want to be in hospital. She was homesick, and she certainly didn't want dialysis. I talked to her, and she suggested that she could come back home to her community, and she said that that's what she wanted. I discussed her wishes with the clinicians, including the specialists and the hospital staff, and helped her navigate the system and navigate the system and advocated for her. It was after this the specialist services seemed to come to the understanding that she wanted palliative care rather than intervention. Her last days were spent peacefully sleeping in her bed at home while monitored for pain, and I also provided pain relief to and assisted the family's needs. Her husband was caring for her, still hunting rabbits and kangaroos for their meals and washing her. She finally went into a coma and slipped away peacefully, surrounded by the sounds, smells, tastes and sensations she had around her all of her life. I felt privileged to be invited into her care and feel that she had a good death in the way that her and her family wanted. That's the kind of stuff you can't measure in quantitative data. And I think we really need to look more and more at qualitative indicators as well, and using the healthcare efficiently, but also measuring quality. Thank you.